RN, your world unfolding.
Hello, this is Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au/radio national. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me. Tonight, a really big and highly contested idea, the Gaia hypothesis. It first came to prominence over 30 years ago when British scientist James Lovelock suggested the Earth should be thought of as a living organism. As you'll hear, the idea was initially embraced and enthusiastically taken up by the general public, but was loathed and detested by the scientific community. Especially savage in his criticism was evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. In this evening's talk, Professor Michael Roos, Director of the Program in the History and Philosophy of Science at Florida State University, examines the great disconnect between the layperson and the scientist when it comes to Gaia. In fact, as he points out, the Earth as a living entity is an old idea, going back at least as far as Plato. But then, with the advent of the Age of Enlightenment in the 17th century, it goes underground, only to resurface with some vigour in the late 20th century, with the rise of the Back to the Earth alternative movement. Before we hear from Michael Roos, let me take you back to an extract from a program I presented on RN in 2009, where James Lovelock recalled the moment the Gaia hypothesis was conceived.
To understand the Earth system, you can't avoid approaching the whole problem to a certain extent intuitively. This is where I think Gaia came in, because most of the first part of it was intuitive rather than rational. When I first came up with it, it was a long time ago, it was 1965. And I can remember it as vividly as if it were yesterday. It was in one of the offices at the place called the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. It's one of NASA's institutions. And there were just three of us in the room. There's Carl Sagan, who probably lots of you remember as a famous astronomer, now sadly dead. There was a lady philosopher called Diane Hitchcock, who I was working with at the time, and me. And we were talking about this endless problem, how do you find life on Mars? And I'd been saying for quite a long time that the best way to do it would just be to measure the atmosphere of the planet. And at that time, NASA were going to send instruments to Mars to measure the composition of the atmosphere. NASA believed it. They weren't against it. And then in marches an astronomer and said, look at this. And he brought out sheets and sheets of data that had been gathered at a French observatory at Pic de Midi by a husband and wife team called Pierre and Jeanine Kahn. And this data showed quite clearly that both Mars and Venus had atmospheres that were almost entirely carbon dioxide, with just traces of other gases present. And according to my theory, it meant they were completely lifeless. So there was no point in NASA sending anything there to find it.
What was it that made you leap to the conclusion that if there was no oxygen, there wouldn't be life?
I didn't really. What the results that this chap brought in from the observatory in France, what that set me thinking in my mind was, well, do we have a control planet with life on? Well, we do, obviously, our own planet. What's special about its atmosphere? Not so much that it contains oxygen, although the amount of it is pretty unusual, 21% compared to the other planet. What's special about it is that you've got oxygen in quantity mixed with methane in quantity, and those are two gases that react together. Every time you light your boiler, you know they do if you're burning natural gas. And the composition had been different, the atmosphere would have been explosive or combustible, which would have been highly undesirable. But if you do your sums, we know that the rate at which methane reacts with oxygen in sunlight, and it means that there must be enormous sources of both of them down on the surface continuously. And much more remarkable than that, we know now from ice core evidence, we didn't know it then, but we suspected it, the amount has been more or less constant for millions of years. So here was something that was incredibly unusual. Chemistry told us that there was nothing that would allow those two gases to have appeared by accident, by ordinary chemistry. So something must be both making them and regulating the amount that was made. And that made me think of Gaia. And then Carl Sagan immediately said, because he was an astronomer, knew about these things, as John would know, that was I aware the sun had been warming up ever since it was born? And this was one of the great puzzles of astronomy. How on earth had the Earth kept its temperature constant over all of those billions of years, despite a warming sun? It's warmed up by about 30% since it formed. And it then came to me instantly, well, if the organisms can regulate gases in the atmosphere, then they can regulate the temperature. Because as we know, you've only to put a little bit extra CO2 in the air, and everybody's getting scared about it.
That seems like a great leap, but you must have arrived at it in stages.
No, it all came out in that bang, bang, bang. But I've been thinking about it, obviously, for a long time beforehand.
That what, in one afternoon in an office in NASA?
Well, it would be about 10 minutes in an office in NASA.
Right. And my last question there was, if Gaia is a self-regulating system, how is it that we're all going to perish? What is going to go wrong from our point of view?
From Gaia's point of view, and I speak for Gaia much more than I do for people, I don't think she gives a damn for us. As far as the planetary system goes, it will always self-regulate so as to sustain habitability. And what we've done is to mess about with the atmosphere, and much more importantly, I think, mess about with the land surface in the way of farming, taking out natural ecosystems that were previously regulating the climate. We've done those two things, a double whammy. And so, naturally, as any living thing would do, when it finds it can't self-regulate and can't defend, it's moving to a place that it knows it can defend, and it's moving to a hot state that it's been in many times before, and it can self-regulate quite comfortably, and we'll have to make do. We won't be destroyed by any manner of means, but the amount of land that will be available for people will be much to live on, will be much less than it was.
James Lovelock, originator of the Gaia Hypothesis, back in 2009 as a 90-year-old. We'll post a link to that 2009 talk he gave on the Big Ideas homepage, abc.net.au/radionational. But now let's head off to the University of Sydney for Sydney Ideas and philosopher Michael Roos, who discusses Gaia and why the concept has been in and out of favour since the time of Plato. His lecture is called The Gaia Hypothesis, Science on a Pagan Planet.
Tonight I'm going to be talking about the so-called Gaia Hypothesis, the idea of the Earth as an organism. I like to describe this as a talk which is on Gaia, but it's not really about Gaia. What I mean by that is I'm not really here to defend Gaia, right or wrong, true or false. You know, I think like most things in this life, it's a bit of both. But what I'm really interested in is using the Gaia hypothesis and the Gaia controversy as a sort of a case study to throw some light on the nature of science. So in a way, this is really philosophy of science, although most of the talk is going to be, as you will see, history of science or history of philosophy. Let's get going and introduce some of the people who are involved in this. This is James Lovelock. He's an Englishman. I think he must be about 94 now. I interviewed him a couple of years ago. He was still very, very bright and very, very with it. He has a science background. He's a chemist. But his great skill is in inventions, in making things that people want. And probably his best known and most important invention was in the 1950s, the electron capture detector, which literally can find three or four molecules in a room. He says, and I don't think he's exaggerating, that if you spilt something on a cloth in Japan, he'd be able to detect it in England in a couple of weeks' time. He makes a lot of money out of this. When I say a lot of money, what I mean is he never had to hold university posts because businesses and as you can imagine, the military were very interested in these abilities, and that's basically the way in which he made his living. And I want to emphasize this a little bit because the early 1960s found Lovelock, Jim Lovelock as he likes to be known, working for NASA, the American space people, in California. And he had an epiphany. He said, "My goodness, the Earth is an organism." Now, it took him a while to develop this, and when he went back to England, actually a very close friend of his was William Golding, the novelist, Lord of the Flies. But Jim worked away on this. In early 1970s, he started to collaborate with this woman, Lynn Margulis. Lynn Sagan. She was the first wife of Carl Sagan. Jim Lovelock and Lynn Margulis, these were people who were good scientists. Jim, by then, he was a fellow of the Royal Society. People said, "We don't normally make inventors fellows of the Royal Society, but this man is really, truly exceptional." And Lynn wasn't at that point, but by 1980, she was made a member of the National Academy of Sciences. These were people with significant, standing and deserved standing in the scientific community. They didn't just say that the world was an organism. They started to put forward some arguments to suggest why one would regard the world as being an organism. In particular, they emphasized homeostasis. And I won't go into this in great detail tonight, but notice that their criterion of what makes an organism is that it, as it were, it keeps itself in balance. It's homeostatic. Feedback mechanisms keep it at this level, as it were. And that, for them, was what made an organism. They were not thinking as biologists in the sense of saying, oh, organisms are things which are produced by evolution through natural selection. They weren't denying that, but they just weren't thinking that sort of way. And I think that makes... one can understand why. Jim was a physical chemist. And Lynn, although she was a biologist, was a cell biologist. She was not in any sense an evolutionist. She was working on the mechanisms of the cell. I mean, she was very much, as it were, somebody looking at the pieces and the parts. There, I want to start with this. Two top-quality scientists, recognized as top-quality scientists, put forward a hypothesis to deal with things which I don't think anybody has questioned were real. In other words, nobody, as far as I can make out, has turned round and said, oh no, the big problem was that the Earth didn't stay more or less static. Nobody's wanted to deny this. And so the question that I go on to ask, and this is what I mean by saying I'm really not interested in Gaia as such, but Gaia as an example. The question I asked then was, what was the reception of this? Now, sociologists of science have something which they call the Matthew Principle, which says basically that good scientists, top-quality scientists, get their work taken seriously in the way that unknown grad students do not. To him that hath shall be given, and from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. So you might at least have said, well, even if people didn't agree with Lovelock and Margulis, they would have taken them seriously and wanted to discuss this in the scientific community. And the simple fact of the matter is that did not happen at all. In fact, Gaia went over in the scientific community like the veritable lead balloon. It was rejected, but it wasn't just rejected. It was loathed and detested. It was the sort of thing, it was considered not just wrong, but at some level deeply unclean, something really deeply offensive. Now, who were the people who took after it? Well, no surprise, who is the scourge of the sloppy? Who is Mr. trying to put right all of the things that we say wrong? None other than Richard Dawkins. And Dawkins, in Dawkins' book, The Extended Phenotype, I think which came out in 1983, Dawkins went after Lovelock with what I can only say, really, venom. I mean, he really went after him and saying that the man's an absolute moron, he's totally mistaken, that this is total nonsense. I want to say, at no point did Dawkins take up Lovelock's arguments and say, well, Lovelock got it wrong about why that the Earth is homeostatic or anything like that. That never came in. It was emoting all the way. And others were much the same. Bob May, who later became Lord May, President of the Royal Society, Bob May called Lovelock a holy fool. And Ford Doolittle, an American who working at Dalhousie, was another one who said, Lovelock writes these warm, comforting little books, but they are not only totally mistaken, but deeply, deeply offensive and going to lead people way astray. So the one side of the thing was not only was it judged wrong, but it was judged, as I say, at some level, really offensively wrong, that there was something, that one ought not to have done something like this. Now, it isn't to say that Dawkins didn't have some arguments, and one of them, and I say I think that this does show disciplinary differences, he said, for the analogy of the Earth as an organism to apply strictly, there would have to be a set of rival Gaias, presumably on different planets. The universe would have to be full of dead planets whose homeostatic regulation systems had failed, with dotted around a handful of successful, well-regulated planets of which the Earth is one. So, of course, one could see, at least at one level, part of the problem was disciplinary differences, that Lovelock particularly was looking at organisms from a different perspective from the way Dawkins was. So we could see that. Now, the other side, the flip side, was by the mid-1970s, Lovelock was realizing he was getting nowhere with the scientific community. So what he did, he pulled a Steve Gould. In other words, he started to write not so much for the general, only for the scientists. I mean, he kept on doing proper science, and he's continued to do quality science all of his life. So that's not been the case. But he started to move into the general domain. And he wrote a little article in New Scientist on the Gaia hypothesis, which had publishers beating their way to his door. He accepted Oxford University Press, and he published Gaia, A New Look at Life on Earth, I think in 1978, 1979. As he said, from that day on, there was a veritable Niagara of post coming through his through his letterbox from then on. But it wasn't from scientists, it was from regular people, it was from academics, it was from theologians, a lot of theologians, it was from the general public, it was from all sorts of people. And what happened was Gaia became incredibly popular, and I want to say has continued to this day to be incredibly popular at a general public sort of level. So you see why I find the 1960s interesting. You see, here's something which comes out of the, as it were, the military-industrial complex, but is rejected by the scientists, and yet picked up by, I won't say just the flower children, but certainly by those people who are particularly into alternative perspectives and things of this nature. One person who picked it up was Mary Midgley. Mary Midgley is a philosopher. She raised a family and then took up philosophy again in the 1970s, and she is no less strong than Dawkins on expressing her ideas. In fact, one of my all-time favorite articles was written by Mary Midgley about Richard Dawkins' selfish gene, which came out in the journal Philosophy, I think in 1979. And this is what she had to say about Dawkins. He's confusing, that his work shows weakness, his attitude is uncritical, his hypotheses are unworkable, his thinking is oversimplified, it is in any case bankrupt, and it's full of speculations. And I want to say that this was page one of 20. It really was. Well, she took up the Gaia hypothesis with enthusiasm. She took it up with enthusiasm and said, yes, this is the kind of perspective on the world that we need, that whether or not Lovelock is right in all of his details, he's clearly right in his vision, and our job is not, as it were, to blast it out into non-being, but to look at it, to work with it, to see if we can improve it, and go forward from there. And she was one of very, very, very many who took this up. Scientists, there were scientists who took it up, particularly people who were working on things like alternative medicine, alternative energies, these sort of things. The people, for instance, who were working at the Schumacher College in Devon in England, people like this. A lot of religious people took it up, and you know, they wrote music, they wrote anthems about Gaia, all of these things. And my favorite of all-time favorite, of course, the pagans took it up with some enthusiasm. So there then is my question, as it were. Why is it that this hypothesis was so rejected by the scientific community and yet taken up so enthusiastically by a wide range of people? I'll talk more about some of the people who took it up over the years in a few minutes. So this is why I, as a philosopher, am interested in this topic. What does it tell me about the nature of science that this sort of thing happens? Now, I'm not only a philosopher, but I'm an ardent evolutionist, and I believe that in order to understand the present, you have to understand the past. In other words, if we're going to understand what we're doing today, then it's necessary to understand some history. I don't present the history to suggest that we're better than the past. That's not what I'm doing in any sense. What I want to do, though, is use history in order, as it were, to give us some understanding about the present. Okay, well, where do we start with history? Well, we start with Plato. Plato, I mean, we could go earlier, but let's start with Plato. Plato, the great Greek philosopher, 4 or 5 centuries before Christ, Plato was, in fact, an enthusiast for the earth having some kind of soul, the earth being animate. And in particular, in his great work, the Timaeus, the first half of the Timaeus, Plato discusses at some length. He says the demiurge, whatever the demiurge might be, this creator, Plato does not believe that the God, the creating God, makes things out of nothing. So Plato's demiurge is not the Christian God, at least directly, of making things out of nothing. He takes the existing material and molds it. He molds it according to the highest ideal, and those of you who know Plato's philosophy knows that he believed in this sort of theory of forms, these transcendental archetypes, of which one was above all others, the good. So Plato said that the demiurge took the earth and molded it according to the idea of the good. And as he did this, the demiurge, in some sense, he infused the earth, he infused the whole world, but certainly infused the earth with a soul, some kind of animated soul. So Plato argues in the Timaeus that the earth is a living organism. You should understand that right from the time of Plato, pretty much right through to almost the end of the Middle Ages, the only work by Plato that people knew was the Timaeus. And it was the first part of the Timaeus, that part which dealt with the earth as an organism. So I want to emphasize as a matter of historical fact how very influential this idea of the earth as an organism. It's known technically as hylozoism. How very influential this was for 2,000 years. It was picked up by Plato's great commentator, the Neoplatonist Plotinus, in the early part of the Christian era. It had to be Christianized, obviously, so they did that. The theory of forms, the idea of the good, was identified with God the Father. The demiurge, the thing that actually did the physical creating, was identified with God the Son, and the world spirit was neatly identified with the Holy Ghost, God as spirit. So in other words, it was Christianized, but it was nevertheless a very important aspect of thinking right up to the time of the scientific revolution, when as you might expect, it started to tumble and received heavy-duty blows. By the scientific revolution, I'm talking about the great development of science, which it didn't exactly start with Copernicus, but we usually mark it as starting with the Polish astronomer Copernicus, and came to an end at the end of the next century with the unifying work of the great English scientist Isaac Newton. Now, the important thing about the scientific revolution was that it regarded, and of course, Descartes was the point man here, but in many respects, the person who was most important, as it were, for articulating the thinking was the chemist philosopher Robert Boyle. But the most important thing about the scientific revolution, if you were like considered philosophically, is that from now on, the Earth is considered to be just matter in motion. So the point I'm making about the scientific revolution, the point I want to emphasize tonight, is that we have a dramatic move from the world as organic. Oh, if the world is organic, if you think of the world as an organism, then it makes sense to ask questions like, what is it for? If I say, for instance, Paul Griffiths is an organism, and then you look at him and you say, well, what's of these funny lug-like things he's got here? It's perfect. I mean, you could ask embryological questions about how these developed, but it makes good sense. In fact, it makes essential sense also to ask about purposes or ends, or what Aristotle called final causes. Why does he have these? He has them in order to hear. So, in other words, if you're thinking organically, it makes very good sense to think in terms of final causes. Coming the scientific revolution, one of the things that the scientific revolution is doing is pushing the discourse of final causes out of science. Descartes, Bacon, Boyle, all of these people are quite explicit that this is what we're doing. We're pushing final cause talk out. So, we're also pushing God out. Now, I want to emphasize that Copernicus was, in fact, a minor prelate. Newton, we think that Newton was a Unitarian, but he was certainly a sincere believer in God, as was Boyle, was extremely religious. Descartes, although he found himself on the index, or rather he didn't, but his successors found him on the index, Descartes lived and died a good Catholic. So all of these people were quite sincere in their belief about God, but what they were doing was pushing God out of science. They were saying, no, we don't need God as an explanation. We don't need God within our science. In other words, to use a phrase of one of the great historians of the scientific revolution, God became a retired engineer. They started off by thinking God had created the world, and they certainly believed that, but increasingly found that that was not helpful in their science, so God, as I say, got pushed out of the discourse. And so, most particularly, there was no place for world spirits or world souls. Matter is dead. So this whole aspect of hylozoism gets pushed out in the scientific revolution. Except, of course, it's very hard to keep a good idea down. In particular, already by the middle, even before, as Newton was writing, in Cambridge, where Newton was, there was a group of philosophers known as the Cambridge Platonists, who were, in fact, not only ardent Platonists, but ardent believers in the fact, the idea that matter is not dead, that matter is in some sense living. Now, a very interesting, and let me just put in a very interesting footnote, Moore was extremely close to Newton. They were very good friends. And one of the things the Cartesians always said about Newtonian physics is that Newton depends on action at a distance, that there are attractions between bodies which are apart. For a Cartesian, that's pretty much a logical contradiction. It's impossible for that to happen. But Newton has it, and the Cartesians said, sort of mutter, 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 this looks to us almost like organic forces. And historians today would say it's quite possible that is so. that in fact Henry Moore deeply influenced Newton in his thinking. So as I say, it's hard to be a consistent materialist. Richard Dawkins sets very high standards for us all that a lot of us, including Isaac Newton, possibly don't quite live up to. Particularly in Europe, mechanism, materialism, anti-organicism, let me call it that, had a pretty rough time in the 18th century, and particularly as chemistry and things like this and magnetism with forces, attractions, all of these sorts of things, and as people worked on physiology and these things, increasingly people said, we are just not comfortable with materialism. This all came to a head, as it were, at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, with a group of thinkers in Germany known as the nature philosophers, the Naturphilosophen, and probably the best representative was Friedrich Schelling in the early part of the 19th century. And these people were quite explicit in thinking that matter, in some sense, is living. Very interesting. Schelling, at the age of 17, wrote a 65-page essay on the Timaeus. And it's clear that Plato had a huge influence. Plotinus, Schelling, you can almost draw a straight line. Now, the point I want to make is that this natural philosophy was something which was very influential, a lot more influential than a lot of people realized, and particularly that this aspect of natural philosophy, that the world is an organism with a world soul. As I say, it's called hylozoism. It's due to one of the Cambridge Platonists in the 17th century. One person who was an ardent hylozoist, one person who was ardent about world souls, was the Austro-German, in fact, I think he was born in Croatia, a mystic and polymath, Rudolf Steiner. He is the founder of the movement which is known as Anthroposophy, and today he's best known as the founder of the Waldorf School organization. And I expect many of you have either come across Waldorf schools in one way or another. He was deeply influenced by Goethe. He was very keen on Goethe's theory of colors, for instance. He was deeply influenced by Schelling. And basically, a very important aspect of Steiner's thinking is that we have these, he believed certainly in occult forces, that we have these kind of occult forces infusing everything. And so consequently, it's very important to think of the world as a living organism. And our agriculture, he called it biodynamic agriculture, our agriculture must reflect this. And he's very keen on natural fertilizers and things of this nature and getting away from the artificial. So that's Germany. America is very interesting. America is much more interesting than England in many respects. America's very interesting because natural philosophy went straight across to America. It went from Schelling to Coleridge, the poet, who cribbed Schelling just wholesale, and then from Coleridge to the American transcendentalists, particularly to Emerson, and then, of course, to his younger colleague, Thoreau. And this is Charles Sanders Peirce, the great philosopher, reporting somewhat sardonically about, I was born and reared in the neighborhood of Concord, that's of course is in New England, at the time, and he was born in 1839, when Emerson and friends were disseminating the ideas they had caught from Schelling and Schelling from Plotinus. So in other words, this whole organicist, world as an organism view, gets into American culture very early. And anybody who's had any education in America, particularly at the secondary level, will know particularly, it's not Emerson, it's Thoreau. So Thoreau's ideas, this whole hylozoism is something which is in the American system. And basically what I'm arguing is I think is the reason why the Gaia hypothesis was taken up with such enthusiasm by the general public. It's because they were ready for it. Hylozoism, Gaia by any name, is an American tradition. It has been for 200 years. When a leading scientist come along and put it forward, people said, yes, of course, we've believed this all along. Isn't it great to have this articulated for us? In this century, the first half of the 20th century, the great nature lover, the great ecologist in the general sense, was Aldo Leopold. And what does Leopold have to say about world souls? Philosophy then suggests one reason why we cannot destroy the earth with moral impunity, namely that the dead earth is an organism possessing a certain kind and degree of life which we intuitively respect as such. I mean, he's quite explicit. The earth is an organism. We ought to love it. Now, the most important figure in this story in the 20th century, of course, is this woman, Rachel Carson, the author of Silent Spring in 1962. You read Rachel Carson, and there is not anything about the world as an organism in that book. I mean, it's so absent, you say, what is going on here? And so you go back to read her earlier works, On the Seashore and other. Rachel Carson didn't come out of nowhere. She was a very well-known writer about the sea and popular books in the 1950s. So she didn't come out of nowhere. You go back to those books, and there's a huge amount of the world as an organism. But why isn't it there in 1962? Well, we know the answer is because she knew she was going to be jumped all over by the drug manufacturers, by the insecticide manufacturers, by the vested interests in agriculture, including the government. She knew that was going to happen. And so she kept all of that explicitly out. What is fascinating is, in fact, Rachel Carson was deeply influenced by the Rudolf Steiner movement. Now, she never was an anthroposophist herself. She was never a follower of Steiner herself. But Rachel Carson's biggest correspondent and the person who fed her most, including pamphlets on the evils of DDT, was a middle-aged woman, the same age as Carson, by the name of Marjorie Spock. She was the younger sister of Benjamin Spock, the pediatrician. And Marjorie Spock, as a young woman, had gone to Germany, or in fact gone to Switzerland, Dornach, where the Steiner movement had its headquarters, and actually studied with Steiner, and was an ardent biodynamic agriculturalist. And the correspondence between Carson and Spock is all extant. It's all at Yale, and I got it, and it's amazing to see how much Spock is feeding this Steiner stuff to Carson, who is using it all, but sanitizing it, not mentioning anywhere. She makes no mention of Marjorie Spock in her acknowledgments. It's so glaring, you know it had to be why it had to be. And of course, the answer is, and Marjorie Spock knew this and was quite open about it and didn't take it personally. Of course, Carson herself was incredibly influential. Arne Nessie, the Norwegian philosopher, the founder of deep ecology, which was very popular in the 1970s. I still remember how popular deep ecology was in the 1970s. I suspect that our thinking need not proceed from the notion of living being to that of the world. But we will conceive reality, or the world we live in, as alive in a wide, not easily defined sense. There will then be no non-living beings to care for. He's quite explicit. The earth is living. I'm not going to mention it tonight, but if you look, for instance, at the work of the ecofeminists, it's all there. Of course, they draw on Carson as a leader, but it's all there. It's very interesting to look at the religious people. The evangelical Protestants don't like Gaia because you see my subtitle, Life at Science on a Pagan Planet. They see Gaia, which it is, as exalting the earth as something of value in itself. And they want to say, no, nothing has value except in as much as it comes from God. Catholics, of course, make up their theology as they go along, feel a lot more comfortable with Gaia. And Catholics are quite comfortable with Gaia. What I have discovered is the Mormons, who in fact, of course, socially are very right-wing. I mean, Mormons, homosexuality make your hair stand on end. But in fact, Joseph Smith actually endorsed Gaia. Joseph Smith actually says that the Earth is an organism. So half my story then is, why was Gaia popular with the general public? And the answer is because it's an American tradition, and you might expect that. Now let's go to the scientists. Why did the scientists react so negatively? And let's pick up the story with mechanism. The scientists, of course, were mechanists. They were anti-final causes. Let's look at the areas of science that Gaia impinges on. Let's look at geology. Let's look at biology. Let's do it rather quickly. Mechanism. The world is a machine working through unbroken law. God is a retired engineer. Let's look at geology. Let's look at biology. Well, geology particularly starts in the 18th century in a big way, and I'm only going to talk about some of them. James Hutton, the gentleman farmer, he had this vision of the Earth, that what happens is there's heat underneath, it pushes it up, and as it were, it comes up to the top, and then you get weathering. And he's very much a kind of proto-plate tectonics thinker. Or if you like, plate tectonics thinkers are very much sophisticated Huttonians. And the reason is, all of them have this model in mind, namely the New Common Machine. And this, of course, was the machine which was invented at the beginning of the 18th century. This is the machine for pumping water out of mines and this sort of thing. And what you have is a furnace here, which heats up the water in here. And then a little bit of cold water, so you get steam. And then cold water is squirted in, and that makes a vacuum and pulls this head down like that. And then once it's pulled down, then the cold water is cut off, and as it were, the steam starts to heat up again and expands and pushes it up. And so what you've got is heat driving round and round and round. And in fact, if you look at Hutton's writing, He's quite explicit about this. Hutton knew people like Boulton and Watt, who were developing a more sophisticated versions of this machine. And in fact, you can trace this right down through the 20th century. Anglo-Australian historian of science, David Oldroyd, has written very illuminating on this. And in fact, that's what you get as you come down to the present. But notice, there's no place for final causes, because although you've got a machine, it's God as a retired engineer. It's just going round and round and round without any point, without any purpose. It's just a machine going round and round and round. So if you start to say things like the Earth is an organism, you're violating the kinds of thinking that mechanism demands. Well, what about biology? Well, of course, biology, the big figure, of course, is Charles Darwin, who not only is an evolutionist, but in his Origin of Species, published in 1859, puts forward his theory of his mechanism of natural selection. More organisms are born than can survive and reproduce. You get a struggle for existence. Some get through, some don't, and those that get through on average are different from those that don't, so you get a kind of natural selecting. And this brings about design-like, it brings about final cause-like entities without final causes. And let me show you some of the finches that Darwin would have seen. In fact, these are finches that Darwin's servant actually shot before they were painted from the Voyage of the Beagle, from the Galapagos. And the important thing is to look at their beaks. And these beaks are adaptations, final cause-like things for eating cactus. And there are other finches with very fine beaks, which are insectivorous. There are even some finches that pick up sticks and poke around tool users to get the insects out. The point is, although Darwin recognizes the final cause nature of organisms, what he's saying is, no, there was no designer. There was no purpose. There was no one planned in some sense, no soul or vital force, as it were, planning or in some sense making the beaks work in order to pick up cactus, making the ears work in order to hear. It's something that all comes about through purposeless, meaningless, blind law. just generation after generation of population explosion brought back down by food and space constraints, struggles for existence, a certain amount of selecting, and so you go on meaninglessly. So this is very much Darwin, but also for Darwin, and Darwin, of course, was a child of the Industrial Revolution. His grandfather was Josiah Wedgwood, the potter, but their Bible was Adam Smith. Their Bible was Adam Smith. And what does Adam Smith say? He says, nobody works for the common good. Nobody works for the common good. We all work for numero uno. If, in other words, to use Richard Dawkins' phrase, we're all selfish genes. Why do you sit down and why does the baker bake the bread for you and the brewer brew the beer for you and the butcher bring the joint for you? It's not for your benefit. It's for his benefit. He does these things and he sells them to you and he benefits himself. And Darwin buys into this completely. So in other words, although Darwin certainly sees integration, of course he does, of course he sees this, he thinks the integration all comes about because things are working at the individual level, and the idea that things would be working for the common good is totally alien to Darwin and to post-Darwinians. So in other words, this at the scientific level, I think, explains, and I think it explains quite quickly, quite readily, quite easily, why scientists were uncomfortable, as it were, qua scientists, with the Gaia hypothesis, that it was bound to fail because it does invoke final causes. It does say that these salt plains exist in order to, for the benefit of Mother Earth. It does ignore natural selection. It does to incorporate, and if you read both Margulis and Lovelock, it is incredibly group selectionist, holistic, where they're constantly saying, oh yes, these things happen. Although these individual organisms may suffer, that's okay, they're doing it for the good of Mother Earth. That they die in order to, eliminate these substances from the atmosphere, and then they get buried, and that's a good thing because it's good for us all. It's good for Mother Earth. So you can see why people were so adamantly qua science opposed. But I still don't think it explains the nastiness. It doesn't explain why were people so nasty. Why did they throw out charges of Gaia being crank science or pseudoscience and that sort of thing? And what I want to suggest is that this isn't really an epistemological issue, but that this is a social issue. This is the point I want to make, that nastiness comes up often not because of the object, but because of the subject. It's when people are feeling insecure in their position that they start to lash out at others. And the point I want to make is that when Gaia turned up in the 70s and early 80s, evolutionary biologists, who were the people who were most adamant against Gaia, were a very unhappy set of campers. Evolutionary biology had developed hugely in the quarter century before that. It had done a huge development, sociobiology, paleontology, systematics, every area had gone ahead. But of course, huge growing pains and huge controversies. For instance, in paleontology, this is John Maynard Smith, probably one of the most eminent English evolutionary geneticists in the second half of the 20th century. And I don't know whether you knew him, Paul, but he really was one of the nicest blokes you could possibly imagine. He was an awfully nice human being, a really warm, loving human being, except when it came to Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould, who was pushing all of his paleontological ideas and anti-Darwinian ideas in the public domain, was dangerous and had to be stopped. And this is John Maynard Smith, years after on Stephen Jay Gould. Gould occupies a rather curious position, particularly on his side of the Atlantic. Because of the excellence of his essays, he has come to be seen by non-biologists as the preeminent evolutionary theorist. In contrast, the evolutionary biologists with whom I have discussed his work tend to see him as a man whose ideas are so confused as to be hardly worth bothering with. I mean, you know, talk about shoving in the knife and twisting and twisting and twisting from one of the nicest people in the business. And so what I'm suggesting is what's going on here is Gould is, you know, is pushing forward all sorts of anti-Darwinian ideas. John Maynard Smith is an ardent Darwinian, and he's taking this very, very personally. He's very tense. Social behavior, sociobiology, was even worse. These are two colleagues, or they were two colleagues, in the same department at Harvard. On the one hand, you had Richard Lewontin. Richard Lewontin was probably the preeminent evolutionary geneticist of his generation, certainly in America. He was the one who took molecular techniques and applied them brilliantly to solving all sorts of problems in evolutionary studies. His colleague was Edward O. Wilson, the great ant specialist and sociobiologist. And what happened when Wilson published his book, Sociobiology, the Modern Synthesis, or rather the New Synthesis? What did Lewontin have to say about his colleague? I have to say, and these people are saying this publicly, you understand. I have to say, my chief feeling, I'll be honest about my chief feeling when I consider all this stuff, is one of disdain. I don't know what to say. I mean, it's cheap. I mean, these people were really tearing each other. They really were very tense. And they admitted that what was making them equally tense was not only fighting each other, but what was going on outside. On the one hand, you'd got all the creationists going after evolutionary theory around about 1980. I was involved in a court case in Arkansas in 81. But then you'd got all the, you know, you'd got all the New Agers and all of these others doing this sort of stuff too. And this is John Postgate, a colleague of John Maynard Smith at Sussex, and another FRS. Science has fallen badly into disrepute in the past couple of decades. Reasons which are multiple and very serious are not relevant just now. The important thing is the consequence of that disrepute. Fringe science, pseudoscience, obscurantism, wishful thinking, and mysticism today find almost medieval favor, even among educated people. And in fact, in this very article, he picks on Gaia as an example. So what I'm saying is that Gaia, as it were, came along at a bad time. He came at a time when evolutionary biologists were feeling very tense, and as it were, got caught. I think today, people are much more inclined to say, well, we don't think the metaphor worked. But you know, Jim really did point to some very important things, and they call it Earth system science now, and that sort of thing. So I think today, a lot of people are inclined to say, you know, Lovelock really did have a point. But right at that time, and this is John Maynard Smith to to Lovelock. As I say, my analysis, the hatred of Gaia by the scientists had less to do with Gaia as such and more to do with their own insecurities at the time that Gaia appeared. And this is John Maynard Smith some years after the Gaia controversy to Jim Lovelock. Look, Jim, all the trouble with Gaia is that we've had such agony with vitalism and group selection and all these other things, and we thought we had it all worked out, and then you came along. You couldn't have chosen a worse moment. And to his great credit, Lovelock says at that point, you know, he says, I really think that they had a point. So what I'm saying is, why was it popular with the general public? Because it's an American tradition. Why was it unpopular with the scientists? Well, first of all, it was out of kilter with the kind of science that they were doing since the scientific revolution. But there's more to the story than that. It was loathed and detested, less because of what it was, and more because of the insecurities of the leading scientists themselves. And that's it, folks. Thank you.
Professor Michael Roos, director of the program in the History and Philosophy of Science at Florida State University. You've been listening to highlights of The Gaia Hypothesis, Science on a Pagan Planet, presented by the Sydney Centre for the Foundation of Science and Sydney Ideas at the University of Sydney. That was recorded in July of last year. And that's it for Big Ideas tonight. Tomorrow night, our summer series concludes when we look at the plight of women in Afghanistan. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.